Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, how boiling water is actually a little more complicated than it might seem.
Is this the point at which the vapor pressure of the water is equal to or greater than the air pressure around it?
Getting spicy with piri-piri peppers, recipes from our grandmothers. Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant recommendation, plus a couple of food trucks that you just have to try. But let's start our show at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season right now here in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're happy to welcome a new vendor at the Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Market, Valerie Confections. And they've been coming to the Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Market since the beginning of October. You've got some sweet and savory things at your booth. It's pastries, mm-hmm. It's pies. So tell us some of the market type items that you're putting in your treats.
Sweet and savory really is the key to what we're doing at the market. So we're taking ingredients and doing two different things with them a lot of the time. Like, for instance, last week we had zucchini bread in its sweet form, which is really delicious and wonderful and a sweet celebration of that squash, and then doing a zucchini, mint, and goat cheese galette, which is a savory application of the same ingredient. And the ingredient that we integrated this week is butternut squash. So this week we're doing butternut squash bread as the sweet application and a butternut squash bread pudding as the savory application.
So tell us how you make the butternut squash bread pudding.
Just to back up for one second, just the name butternut squash to me, it just says so much about that fruit, which is it's buttery and it's nutty. And you really just want to sort of bring out those flavors in anything that you make with butternut squash. So in the butternut squash bread pudding, you know, natural additives, nutmeg, butter, all these sort of delicious things that just sort of enhance it. One of the great things about butternut squash to me is it's a squash that is just so smooth. It just has this real sort of purity of texture that's just a pleasure to eat. It really is. So in the butternut squash bread pudding, approaching it the same way as you would pretty much any bread pudding. So sort of day-old, two-day-old, three-day-old bread, soaking it in a mixture of, a lot of people use half and half for milk. I use full-fat cream. Eggs.
My kind of recipe.
Eggs. We're doing Gruyere this week as a cheese, so that all sort of mixes together with a healthy shaving of nutmeg, salt, pepper. You let that sit for a little bit. And then we're also adding some nice hearty greens to this butternut squash bread pudding. This week we're doing kale that is sautéed with shallots and leeks, and the butternut squash, we're doing two different things with it. We're roasting all of it, so cutting into about an inch and a quarter cubes, inch and a half cubes, covering it in a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, roasting it for about 15 to 20 minutes just so it becomes a little bit pliable. Half of that we're pureeing, half of it we're leaving in those chunks. So as the butternut squash bread pudding comes together, it's almost like a lasagna. You're sort of building it in a baking pan.
Well, this is so great, Valerie. Well, this sounds delish, and I know you've got a great reception down there at the Saturday market. Your stuff is beautiful,
Thank
and
you.
I love the integrity and the passion that you bring to it. Thank you.
Take good care. Thank you.
Sandra Newman has been a regular at the Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Market. Her farm is called Forbidden Fruit, and she sells certified organic blueberries. She's now starting at the Wednesday market, and she's in now. She'll be in for about a month with her berries here. And Sandra, you have gorgeous blueberries. I've been to your farm. You have a certain variety that's available now at this time of year that not too many people have. So talk to us about the blueberries and then also about your jam and your honey. You bring a few other things as well.
Yes, right now we have Sapphire. That's the variety that's in flower and producing right now. It's a very low-chill variety, and that actually will keep setting fruit all year unless we tell it not to.
Now, low-chill means what?
It means the hours below 45 degrees. And every plant has that. There's been breeding programs from many universities trying to create the lower chill, and that's basically what now Florida, California, and all the southern states grow, where we can have 300-400 chill hours.
instead of how many for normal blueberries?
Well, northern blueberries can be up to 8 to 1,000 chill hours. Uh-huh. On my farm, I run between 600 and 700 hours of chill below 45. So I look for low chill varieties on everything that I grow. So
it's so interesting that they're actually adapting the fruit to the climate so they can grow in Southern California.
Yes, and that brings local fruit to, you know, customers nearby where they can get this great fruit in different varieties that can be produced almost all year round.
Yeah. So we're not sacrificing any of that wonderful blueberry flavor that we love in the Northern California blueberries for the low chill.
Right.
So these are Sapphire variety. It's the one variety, because we're used to getting several varieties sort of combined in a pack, you know, from the other
in the
growers.
Summertime, I will do that. Uh-huh. Right now, my Sapphires are in. In around November, my Emeralds will come in. And then around February, I'll be picking Jewel. And my other varieties stay in during those times. So that's when usually like March, April, you'll start to get all the mix where you'll get all three varieties. We can make it through the winter because our blueberry plants stay evergreen. They don't go deciduous because we're close to the ocean. And I have a frost protection sprinklers over them. So I can protect down to 29 degrees. But a hard freeze, I'm out of luck. But I brought my honey with us.
Is that blueberry? Is that from the blueberry grove?
Right, the bees are on the east side of my blueberry field, so they pollinate the blueberries and they pollinate the apples and everything else on the property and my lavenders, and they go off the property, and that's why it's not certified organic, because I can't control where the bees go. They might go to my neighbors, you know. So, and then we also make a syrup and a jam from our blueberries.
That was Sandra Newman. Our farm is called Forbidden Fruit, and she has certified organic blueberries. She's got some lovely honey and some homemade preserves as well. You can find her at the Saturday Santa Monica Market if the blueberries haven't frozen, and then seasonally in the Wednesday Market. Next Wednesday, October 27th, we will have our ever-popular all-you-can-carry pumpkin patch, and we are keeping the price at $5, and it is our fun, entertaining, spectator-driven pumpkin patch where you walk into a pile of pumpkins, and however many pumpkins you can carry over a 25-foot runway, you are allowed to keep. Pumpkin carry starts at 8:30, and it goes until the pumpkins are gone. Pumpkin patch is set up at 2nd in Arizona on Wednesday, October 27th. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures of the produce we talked about and a recipe from Valerie Gordon are at kcrw.com/goodfood. We also shoot video at the market. Check them out on the Good Food app for the iPhone or the iPod Touch. They're also online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You'll find them on the right side of the page.
Look like you can't get enough. Fix your pot of soup and make you drink it up. So keep on eating. Oh, keep on eating. Keep on eating, baby, till you get enough.
If you have a relative who makes delicious things in the kitchen, stand by them and learn before it's too late. Erica Karakesh, the blogger behind In Erica's Kitchen, learned the hard way that recreating a recipe from written material can be a challenge. So, Erica, you decided that you wanted to make your grandmother's rugelach.
Of the things that she made, the rugelach were the thing that everybody looked forward to. Once or twice a year, she would make them. She would make a pretty large batch. She would put them in Ziploc bags and hand some to my mother. She would send some to California where my aunt and uncle lived. My aunt and uncle would send them to my cousins in college, that sort of thing.
So during the time she was alive, you never actually wrote down or stood by her and made it with her and took notes at the same time?
I think that's because my mother hates to cook, and it seems to skip a generation in our family. And I didn't really get the cooking gene till I was older. And I did sit down and make them with her once after I was out of college. We were in her tiny little kitchen in their tiny little house in Queens. I remember it was warm outside and the planes from LaGuardia were flying over. So she would give me instructions and we'd have to stop for an airplane and then we'd start talking again. So she had a kitchen table maybe about the size of the table we're looking at here, which is about 3 by 6. And she would make the dough on the table, similar to the way that you see you know, Italians making pasta dough. She would put all the dry ingredients on the table and mush them up with her hands to mix them and then make a well. And then I stopped paying attention. And so when she died quite suddenly. And my mother was looking through her recipes and she found the recipe for the rugelach in her handwriting. And the recipe has ingredients, but it has no method. And so I looked at the recipe and I couldn't figure out what to do.
Now, let me ask you this. A lot of grandmothers start out with recipes with the full fat version. And as they age, they can change things up because they want it to be more heart healthy, let's say. Did that happen with your grandmother as well?
It was an interesting situation because my grandmother was an excellent baker, but she also taught weight loss classes for the New York Board of Health. And she would run these classes in her basement and she would talk to almost all women about managing calories. And she had the 600 calorie a day diet, the 800 calorie a day diet, and the 1,000 calorie. And then she would make these rugelach. And I think, you know, given that we, let's just say, all of us have almost always been on a diet and it doesn't actually seem to be doing any of us any good. But she was of the mind that, you know, if you looked at the recipe and you saw shortening and sour cream, something bad was going to happen. So she did create a version of the rugelach that substituted orange juice for the sour cream.
Now, when I hear that, I think of sour cream with its luscious fattiness. And then I think of orange juice with its lean citric acid quality. And I think, well, they both are acidic.
And I think the acidic part of it is actually good for the dough. I sort of like the flavor of the orange juice version, but when I tried that version, it was like rolling out muffin batter. I mean, it's so loose and wet, and it just, I could not get it to hold enough so that I could roll it out, because the way that you make rugelach, or these rugelach anyway, because they're rolled up cookies, is you make a circle of dough and you roll out a circle and then you cut it into wedges and you put the stuff on it. And then I discovered the very important part is you take the rolling pin and you press the raisins and nuts into the dough, otherwise they all fall out. But rolling the dough thin enough so that the finished cookie ends up being more about the filling and less about the dough is just impossible. I don't know how she did it.
But are the ones made with sour cream and shortening easier?
They are easier to handle, but it doesn't taste like grandma's rugelach, at least the ones I remember, because since I was probably in grade school, she was making it with orange juice.
And when I look at the picture on your blog, if I could use the Cantor's rugelach as the other example, which I think are probably made with a cream cheese dough, the dough is more puffy.
This is more like a cross between a pie crust and a sugar cookie. It's crisp. When you bite into it, it's got a little heft to it. It doesn't give. It's got that sort of thick pie crust bottom feeling, but it's got the flavor of a sugar cookie. It's impossible. And the other thing is these are bigger. You know, the Cantor's rugelach, they're little like this. These are, you know, crescent roll shaped. They're fairly substantial. But what we used to do when she would make them for our family is my mom would take the Ziploc bags and put them in the freezer so that we would not eat them as quickly. The only problem is they taste really good frozen.
I mean, of course you're going to go in and take one out and not wait until it defrosts.
You can defrost it by dunking it in coffee.
There you go.
So that's the important part.
Well, this has been so much fun. Thank you very much for sharing this with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Get the recipe for Erica's grandmother's rugelach at kcrw.com/goodfood. I think for many people, Italian food is inextricably linked to this idea of a grandmother in the kitchen stirring sauce and making pasta by hand. Author Jessica Thoreau got a grant to study food traditions in Italy, and that, of course, led her to a grandmother.
I started with Mama Maria, who was in my life when I was younger. We had an Italian au pair, and she was her mother, and we would go during holiday times and stay with her and be fed by her. So I started with her and with some other contacts, and when I first arrived, I was unsure as to where exactly it was going to go. And over time, realized that I really just loved being with these older women in their kitchens, listening to their stories and cooking with them, chopping with them, stirring with them, foraging with them. And so the project really took a turn only towards that,
Did you find that young Italian women of your same age thought you were a little crazy to be so interested and excited?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the younger generation is much more interested in the workplace now. And the young women that I met loved their grandmother's food. However, it wasn't a place where they were putting a lot of time and energy. So they couldn't really understand it, but they were glad that I was documenting these traditions nonetheless.
Did you find that a lot of these traditions were not getting passed on?
I think a lot of them are not, because they take time. I think that there is another thing, which is that when we talk about food traditions, what I really learned there was that what each cook brings to a dish really changes it. So that the traditions, I think, to some degree are being passed on, although changed with each generation and with what the local farmers are growing and what's available. But they're also being lost because people aren't taking the time anymore.
Share with us one of your favorite women and what some of the traditions were that she passed on to you.
Armida stands out to me. She was a sharecropper in the hills of Lunigiana, up from Liguria. And just the pride that she took in her food. I mean, she had grown up without any money, to the degree that she didn't end up making it through elementary school because she didn't have a chicken to bring the teacher. The other children would bring chickens and get good marks, and she would gather apples and wild cherries. And so she led this very, very humble, very simple life, was still a sharecropper at 96 when I met her. And somehow her food, I think in its simplicity and in the care that she put into it, you know, I remember being homesick and sad one day and going over, and we'd sit on her sofa together and just be quiet. And she's hoisted herself up and went and cooked this pine nut cake that she used to love as a young girl that would make her feel happy when she was having a hard time. So just things like that, her and her son killing one of their chickens and boiling it slowly, filled with bread and herbs and cheese and eggs, you know, just these very sort of simple, humble dishes that really nourished me on a really deep level.
Thank you so much, Jessica. It's been such a treat.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
Jessica Thoreau's book is Cooking with Italian Grandmothers, Recipes and Stories from Tuscany to Sicily. Is there a recipe from your grandmother that you'd love to share? We would really like to hear about it. Just post a comment on today's show and include the recipe if you like. Up next, some new but familiar concepts in mobile dining. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. When I say meals on wheels, do you think of Kogi or the Nom Nom truck or maybe one of the other many food trucks in L.A.? Or do you think about the hundreds of thousands of homebound seniors having meals delivered every day? Well, how about both? Introducing Cart for a Cause, a fundraising effort benefiting St. Vincent Meals on Wheels.
My name is Greg Sato, and I'm on the Junior Advisory Board of St. Vincent Meals on Wheels, which is the arm that runs Cart for a Cause. Cart for a Cause is different from all the other food trucks in Los Angeles because, one, it's the first that's fully philanthropic in nature, so all proceeds from Cart for a Cause go directly to supporting the mission of St. Vincent Meals on Wheels. And then, secondly, it's the only food truck in Los Angeles, or the only one nationally that I know of, that actually has a rotating roster of chefs and restaurants that come in every 2 weeks and create a custom menu specifically for the truck. So we've had, you know, some of the best chefs and some of the most well-known restaurants of the city, ranging from Susan Finnegan and Street, Nobu Matsuhisa with Nobu West Hollywood, Jean-Francois Metanier from La Cachette, to Chef Nicholas Peter at The Little Door. Lexus was generous enough to come on as our Archangel sponsor, so they're on board with us the entire year. The nice thing about your $10 as well is you're not just getting a lunch, but you also get a drink, you also get a cookie, and you also get a bag of pistachios too for a little, you know, mid-afternoon snack. So we found that people were having trouble carrying all of this stuff, so Lexus was nice enough to give us bags. And, you know, other sponsors that came on board with us was, you know, Fiji Water and Palm Wonderful. They're the exclusive beverage partners of the truck. Wonderful Pistachios and Everybody's Nuts provide the little 100-calorie packs of pistachios. We have Miss Lily's Cookies, which is, you know, really delicious cookies, and Repurposed Compostables. They provide all of the environmentally sound to-go containers, as well as, you know, forks and spoons and silverware and things like that.
I'm Daryl Twardall, and I'm the executive director of the St. Vincent Meals on Wheels Foundation. We do about 4,700 meals a day that we prepare and send out throughout Los Angeles every day. And our mission is different than any government-supported programs because we're privately funded. So our mission is to serve anyone who's homebound, regardless of age, race, religion, ethnicity, disability, and most importantly, ability to pay. So that's really where we feel the need in the community, and we're really the safety net program because with the government programs cutting back and the need growing, we get more and more calls.
On Tuesday, Cart for a Cause will be at 9100 Wilshire in Beverly Hills. The chef will be Ilan Hall of the Gorbals, and he's serving burgers, twice-fried chicken, and potato latkes. Food trucks use social networking to let people know where they're going to be. Looking for a bite to eat? Check Facebook or your Twitter feed. Of course, this isn't just happening in L.A. Gustavo Arellano of the OC Weekly stops by occasionally to share a restaurant recommendation in Orange County. According to Gustavo, OC residents have their fair share of tweeting trucks, too.
I always remind people that Roy Choi of Kogi Barbecue, he's from Orange County. He's ours. And so, you know, for better or for worse, he is ours. And I call them the Lux Loncheras because they're still loncheras. They have aspirations to be somehow better than Mexican food trucks, which is a whole other rant I could go on for an hour. But it is a big scene. And so what I've done, though, I'm still skeptical just because I've been eating at loncheras my entire life. I like a lot of them, but I've yet to see any that can match up to some of the loncheras that we've talked about here on Good Food. So what I make loncheras do, these Lux Loncheras, every week I tell them, come in on Monday to the OC Weekly offices, feed us. We're going to pay, of course, and then I'll review you, but I'm not going to go find you. There's only been one exception to the rule of places that I've actually reviewed in my regular column, and it has been Piaggio on Wheels, which is an Argentinian food truck.
And what do they have? What is typical of Argentine food that is suitable for a truck?
They love meat, like Mexicans love meat. They love sandwiches. Their tortas are kind of like ours, except a little bit more Italian. I'm actually surprised that Los Argentinos, they hadn't thought of getting into the lonchera scene before, because it's a natural, you know, they love beef, Mexicans love beef, and they love cheap food, which is one of the reasons why I liked it, and they know how to make it perfectly. So we'll start with, of course, you have to start with the sandwich de milanesa, a massive fillet of chicken or beef. I like the chicken one better. Breaded, it's about as thick as a pinky, it's golden brown, and they put it in a huge sandwich or a huge French roll. They minimal dressing, a little bit of mayonnaise, a little bit of repollo, a little bit of onions.
That would be cabbage.
Cabbage, yeah. Sorry, I'm thinking Mexican right now.
That's okay.
And it's $4. It's a big, massive meal that if you go to an Argentinian restaurant, they would charge you an arm and leg for it, and rightfully so, because milanesa, it's big and it's very good. But the great thing about the owner, Jose Piaggio, he used to own an Argentinian steakhouse in Brea. Economy went down, so he decided to go into this food truck. Now he has the skills of Argentina to make great meat, and now he's doing it in this food truck. So I would start with the milanesa sandwich. I'm obsessed with milanesa, and I think this is the best one in Orange County right now.
Wow. So if we've had a milanesa on Monday, what would we have on Wednesday?
On Wednesday, then, you have to go for the empanadas. Actually, it's funny because there's such an emphasis on meat. Of course, Argentinos, they live and breathe beef. But Biagio's specialty, according to him, is the empanada. And here he starts getting a little bit more fusion-y. He does a caprese version of an empanada. You have this golden flaky shell. Small empanadas, they come about three to an order. Inside, though, you immediately, the basil just jumps into you. You get the cheese, you get a little bit of ham in there, you get the tomatoes, all fresh flavors. I think it's hard when it comes to empanadas. I've never really been a fan of savory empanadas just because they could get overwhelmed really quickly and there's no nuance to it. But in this caprese empanada, you really do taste the nuance that makes a caprese salad so delicious.
And that would be the traditional Italian salad of tomato, mozzarella, and basil.
Exactly.
That's sort of genius to put it in an empanada.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever seen it done this way. I've had other caprese empanadas at other Argentinian places, but again, one flavor overwhelms the other. Usually it's the crust, the buttery crust that just, you know, makes it flat. No, here in Piaggio's, you get the different flavors. They get presented to you as they go onto your palate. Really, really great. He also makes another one, chicken empanada, mixes up olives, mixes up shredded chicken, kind of a mustardy aftertaste too. Really, really good as well. And the great thing, of course, about these Lux Loncheras, though, what I do like about them is that they're always introducing different things. Piaggio, he's even presenting one of the few times Argentinos and Mexicans have ever agreed on something. And so he's making a burrito with skirt steak and Argentinian chorizo as well.
Oh, that would be delicious.
Oh, he is a master of the grill. The chorizo that he makes it himself. So he cases it. He grills it all. I taste a bit of cinnamon in his chorizo. I also like that as a chorizo sandwich, choripan. That's what Argentinos call it. But in the burrito, you know, I never imagined chorizo that flavorful inside a flour tortilla. And he also puts in guacamole. He also, you know, it's basically the Mexican structure with Argentinian ingredients. For once, honestly, our two races can agree on something, that this is really delicious. And I'm not going to hold against Argentina that they beat us in soccer during this cup. No, no.
So let's talk about this Lux Lonchera in the OC. Are the same names going back and forth between Los Angeles and Orange County, or down there, do you have a series of trucks that are purely in the OC?
There are some that just stay in Orange County mostly. They're all going to go wherever the money is. But Orange County has proven, at least as the eaters, that there is a Lux Lonchera scene where people can now park three or four at a time. You could hit up, of course, a Piaggio's. You could get vegan. You can get, there's a great crepes truck, Crepes Bonaparte, that came out in the recent Food Network show, The Great Food Truck Race, or whatever. They went pretty far as well. So you do have enough of a scene. And sometimes they do go to Orange County. But again, I'm still skeptical about that. They're all good. I've liked them so far. But Piaggio, to me, is the one that has really excelled at offering great food, but also an affordable food. There's a Lux Lonchera. I'm not going to name them because I've gotten in a fight with them already. They're really good, but they made this amazing lamb pita, tiny little thing, about as big as a huge taco for $8. That's not lonchera cuisine. That is, sure, it might be fusion cuisine. You might be experimenting, but I'm going to eat it only once as a food critic. I'm not going to eat it as a diner. I'm going to go to Tacos El Chavito in Huntington Beach and order two tacos for $1 and free pineapple juice. Or I'm going to go get the Battleship Taco in Santana at Alebrijes. Or I'm just going to go to Piaggio, get myself a massive Milanesa sandwich for $4 and not bat a single eye.
What is the Piaggio Twitter name?
You go to twitter.com/Piaggio. So that's Piaggio on wheels. Piaggio on wheels. Twitter.
And it's kind of cute because Piaggio, it's his name, but it's also the name of a famous scooter.
You see, I know nothing about Italians or Argentinians. Thank you, Evan, for finding that.
Thank you, Gustavo. Always a pleasure.
Gracias.
Gustavo Arellano is the food editor for the OC Weekly, where he writes the very popular Ask a Mexican column. All of Gustavo's restaurant recommendations are on the Good Food Restaurant Map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. You'll also find Jonathan Gold's picks there, too. The Pulitzer Prize winners with me a bit later in the show. But first, how to boil water. Really. I'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to KCRW and kcrw.com.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. You know when people who can't cook say, I can't even boil water? Well, if you think about it, boiling water is actually pretty complicated. That is, if you approach it from a scientific level, as Kenji Lopez-Alt did in his Food Lab column for Serious Eats.
Water's a bunch of molecules, like a bunch of chickens in a coop. And, you know, if you start feeding those chickens Red Bull, you know, give them a lot of energy, eventually one of them is going to jump over the fence, fly out of the coop. And that's sort of what happens with water at normal temperatures. You know, the hotter you get it, the more water molecules jump off the surface of the water and go into the air as water vapor. And boiling is the point at which, you know, the fence that's holding those chickens in, which in the case of water is the air pressure around us, you know, the pressure that the air is exerting on us right now and on the pot of boiling water. It's when the pressure of the water underneath it becomes greater than the pressure of the air pressing down on it. So suddenly that fence breaks and all of those water molecules rush out and quickly convert to steam and fly off into the atmosphere. So that's basically what boiling is. It's the point at which the vapor pressure of the water is equal to or greater than the air pressure around it.
I love that metaphor, the chicken in the coop metaphor. Okay, let's talk about the continuum between cold water and water at a full boil, because it goes through all of these stages. So sort of take us through the different stages, starting with a simmer all the way to a rolling boil.
Actually, even below a simmer, you have a sub simmer, and that's when little bubbles are starting to form on the bottom of the pot. Those bubbles form at, you know, really tiny microscopic scratches and abrasions on the surface of the pot called nucleation points, which you can't see with your eye, but basically every place that you see a bubble, that's a place where the pot has a microscopic ding or a nick in it. And so when you see those little bubbles forming and maybe a couple of lazy streams of them rising to the top, that's called a sub simmer. And that happens in the range between, you know, around 140 up to around 160 degrees or so. And a lot of dishes are actually best cooked in that kind of water. If you want to really gently poach a fish, say poaching salmon or poaching a halibut, things that you don't want to overcook at all, they work really well at low temperatures like that. And then once you get above that, you're at an actual simmer, and that's when bubbles are rising in a really steady stream, and you see the top surface of the water quivering. And that's in the range from, you know, 160 to around 185 or so. And then once you're past the subsimmer, you're at a boil. And water will actually start bubbling pretty rapidly a little bit below the 212 degrees, which we know is the boiling point. But once you've finally reached 212 degrees, then you're at a full rolling boil. And that's when you want to cook things like pasta or green vegetables, things that you want to cook really rapidly with a lot of motion so that they cook evenly.
Wow, interesting. So let's go through some myths, some water boiling myths. Cold water heats faster than hot water.
Right. That one just sounds a little ridiculous, right off the bat. A lot of people really do believe that. And I think the basis for that myth is that there is a good reason to use cold water instead of hot water when you're boiling or for things like tea, coffee. And that's that the hot water coming out of your pipes has a lot more dissolved minerals in it because hot water dissolves minerals better. So there's a lot of dissolved minerals from your piping, iron, things like that, that can get into your water, and that can affect the flavor of coffee or tea or more delicate aromatic things like that. So it's always a good idea to start with cold water whenever you're gonna brew a drink. But it's not gonna boil any faster than the water out of the hot water tap would.
Okay, now salt. When you add salt, it raises the boiling point of water, right?
It does, but not to a very significant degree, not to a degree that it's going to actually affect your cooking or to a degree that you can probably even measure it. For most cooking applications, you know, say you're cooking pasta or green vegetables, you're going to add probably at most a tablespoon of salt per quart of water. And that amount of salt is really not going to affect the boiling temperature by more than a degree or so, probably even less than 1 degree. And that changes that small don't really affect the way things cook that much.
So then some people are listening and they're saying, but wait, how can that be if you have water and it's almost at the boil and then you take salt and you throw it in, it will immediately come to the boil?
Yeah, exactly. It does do that, and that goes back to the point about nucleation sites. What it does is it adds a lot of turbulence to the water. It adds a lot of little particles, and those little particles of salt are the areas where steam can suddenly form.
So interesting. Now, alcohol, we're told that it completely boils off when we're cooking.
It will eventually completely boil off, but at the point that it boils off is basically when you've reduced the liquid down to nothing. So it's very, very difficult to remove all the alcohol from a stew or a sauce or something like that. Really, the most you can do is reduce it. You reduce it down to about probably 10% of its starting, depending on whether you're cooking with the lid on or lid off. You know, if you cook with the lid on, you might end up even with, you know, say 40% of what you started with after cooking for even an hour. Because, you know, alcohol, when you're boiling, alcohol and water are both coming off in that steam, but they're both also staying. It's not like the alcohol is just evaporating on its own while the water is sitting in the pot. They're both coming out of there. And so you're reducing the alcohol, but you're also reducing the water. So the concentration of the alcohol doesn't change all that much. You know, so even after a few hours of boiling, you're going to be left with some amount of alcohol.
Okay, now covering pots. Do covered pots come to a higher temperature than uncovered pots?
They do, but you know, it's similar to the salt. They'll certainly come to a boil faster, just because you're retaining heat in the pot. You know, you're keeping the energy in the pot rather than allowing it to escape to the atmosphere. But it's not going to come to a significantly higher temperature than it would when it's uncovered. You know, a couple exceptions might be is if you have a particularly weak burner and a really large pot of water. That pot of water, when it's uncovered, might be losing energy so fast that it'll never come to a boil, given the small heat underneath. In which case, putting a lid on it will help. But you know, whether the lid is on or off, a boil is around 212 degrees, maybe slightly higher when the lid is on, but it's not enough to make a huge difference.
Kenji Lopez-Alt writes the Food Lab column for Serious Eats.
Hey, hey, senor waiter, we're here tonight. Me and my baby gonna do it upright. Turn the tablecloth over, here's a peso for you. Tequila for the crowd, and tacos for two. Tacos for two.
We're so lucky to have Jonathan Gold here on Good Food. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, he's taking us to Tinga, a Mexican restaurant on La Brea in Midtown. It turns out that the restaurant is named after a dish.
Tinga is a stew. It's sort of shredded meat or chicken in spicy, sometimes smoky sauce. You find it a lot on poblano menus, but it's pretty common almost anywhere in Mexico, I think.
Okay, so what did you really like there?
Tinga is a stylish taqueria that they're taking the idea of the taqueria, they're charging more for it. They're using really high quality ingredients. They're making the tortillas themselves. They're making the salsas themselves, and they're serving everything in a very ecologically responsible manner. Sometimes that doesn't make for the very best Mexican cooking, but in this case, I think they do a nice job.
What were some of the dishes that you tried that you really loved?
The menus around there revolve around the taco in its myriad forms. There's a really nice one of, short ribs with a little bit of smokiness to them and potatoes. There's a one of cochinita pibil, which is the Yucatan pit roasted pork. In this case, not quite pit roasted and doesn't quite have the concentration of flavor that you'd find with maybe the best Yucatan versions, but it's very clean and comes with those beautiful bright red marinated onions that I know you especially like.
Yum.
Weirdly enough, the actual tinga may be one of the least interesting things on the menu. It's shredded chicken in a chili sauce, and it comes with, your usual garnishes of, you know, shredded greens and a sprinkling of cheese and a little dab of crema. It's nice. If you're getting a bunch of tacos, it might be one of them. But I think you'd probably be happy with, like, you know, the really nice, you know, grilled steak taco, which does have the depth of flavor and does have that, you know, nice crackly burnt.
What about the meal accompaniments, like beans or salads? How do they handle the other parts of the dishes?
Everything is a la carte. The beans are really nice. They do white beans sometimes, which is a really fresh, almost salad-y with like cucumber and mint and epazote. But they also do sort of a really deep-tasting beans layered with cream that are just, you know, super creamy.
Ooh, yum. That sounds delicious.
They do a rice dish that, oddly enough, tastes something like something my mom used to do for special occasions in the 60s. But cooked to almost dissolving, to almost a rice pudding stage with cream and cheese and roasted chilies.
Mm.
And if you hit it right, and you probably won't this time of year, there's a really nice watermelon salad with queso fresco.
Sounds wonderful.
The signature dish of the place is probably – well, I mean, obviously the signature dish is the tinga, but they do a really, really good job with corn, like sweet corn grilled, you know, cut off the cob, tossed with lime. There's a little bit of cream. It's really, again, like, you know, deep tasting and sweet and buttery and wonderful. I mean, it's very rare that the side vegetable dish – on the side is going to be the thing that you go back to and back to and back to and back to. But, you know, the corn is super good here.
No, that's good. That's wonderful.
It is one of those artisanal places, so you can be sure that they make their own agua frescas, you know, every day, which means that they're probably going to be out of the one that you want, but it's okay because there'll be something good anyway. You know, either the house-made horchata or they do a really nice watermelon one or cantaloupe drink. And they even roast their own coffee beans, which I think is that one step extra that I've never seen in a Mexican restaurant before.
How wonderful.
You know, it's not like going to a taco truck to your beloved Leo's in the middle of the night. It's, you know, it's well appointed. There's a big long table that everybody sits along. And you go up to the counter and order and then you go up and get your food. It's not table service, but it's nice enough to sort of bring a date after a movie or something.
Wow, fantastic. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Tinga's on La Brea, just south of Beverly. To get the info, you can text the words good food to 69866. You'll get a text message back with Tinga's exact address. That's the words good food to 69866. I'll be back after this short break with New York Times columnist Mark Bittman. That's next. This is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. What is there to say about the phenomenon called Mark Bittman? He doesn't seem to do anything half-hearted. He's turned his prolific ability to turn out eminently doable recipes to food that matters in his new cookbook, Food Matters. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Evan.
So you've had this sort of conversion experience over the last few years.
Okay, we can say that. It doesn't feel exactly like a conversion. It feels like a progression, but I won't quibble.
No, it is a progression. I think it's a progression that a lot of us have been on, actually.
Right.
But I think that personally you started changing the way you ate before your recipes started to completely reflect that change. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it's a totally fair assessment. And I think I changed the way I was sort of like a closet better eater for a couple of years. Like I had changed the way I ate and my friends knew about it, but I didn't exactly go public because I was afraid I was going to get teased for, I don't know, A, changing and B, not eating enough meat, which I actually honestly have taken some flack in some circles for like not upholding the meat eating cause.
I also share the conundrum about sort of talking about this way of eating. What do you call it?
Well, what I call it and what it gets called are two different things, but I call it less meatarian. I know. See, that's the problem, is I call it less meatarian and people laugh at me.
Yeah, but that's good. Laughter is good.
It's the most simple descriptive way I can come up with it. Basically, it's, you know, it's semi-vegan, which also sounds ridiculous, but it's just, it's more plants and less of everything else.
I much prefer preparing vegetables to preparing meat. I don't know what it is, if it's the colorfulness of it. So it feels like a very natural thing.
Well, I think it's natural in many, many ways. And it's, you know, although I came to this from, I think I came to this in many ways for the wrong reasons. Or that is, they were good reasons, but they were external reasons. That is, they were political reasons, or they were reasons for of my concern for global welfare, or they were reasons of my concern for my own welfare. But the fact is, I think it's really quite simple and natural, and you could come to the same conclusions just by kind of acting instinctually. And now when I talk about this stuff, this lesbitarian stuff or whatever you want to call it, I say it's really just about moving in, all of us moving in the same direction. And if we all move in the same direction, we eat better, we're nicer to animals, we sort of encourage both organic and local production, we encourage world health, we discourage global warming. I mean, everything sort of, even if it's just a tiny little bit, everything moves in the right direction. To me, this is what society is about, the greatest good for the greatest number, right? So I'm not going to not eat better because I'm ashamed that I can afford it. That would be self-destructive. But I am going to work to make sure, or to try to make sure, that people who can't afford to eat as well as me do have access to the same food I have.
We have to acknowledge that one of the reasons that meat is put forward so much in the American diet has a lot to do with interests that the government listens to.
Right. Well, the funny thing is, or one of the ironies of this, is that if you say, well, I would like to be able to subsidize the way poor people can shop at farmers markets. I would like to be able to see a battalion of cooks, a cooking conservation corps around the country who help people learn how to cook, or if people needed help actually getting the cooking done, then helping them getting it done, and so on down the line. And then people say, well, that's subsidies, that's welfare. And I say, yeah, that's fine. Right now we're subsidizing the growing of corn and the growing of soy, and we're subsidizing agribusiness. So let's stop those subsidies and start subsidizing actual living people.
One of the things that intrigued me is this idea of turning pasta around and making pasta be a much more sort of vegetable-intensive dish and less of a starch dish. Is that the kind of idea that you're doing with meat as well?
There are basically two ways to eat less meat. One is you can eat less meat. I mean, you can say, okay, this meal has no meat in it. Or you can say, this chicken that now served four people now serves eight people. If you're going to become a vegan, it makes things simple in a way, although it's a challenging way to eat. But if you're not going to become a vegan, the one thing you can do is have meals where you eliminate meat or animal products in general. But the other thing you can do, and this is a big part of Food Matters Cookbook, is to create dishes that feature meat as, you know, a treat, a treasure, the stir-fry kind of philosophy in which little bits of meat or fish or whatever are fun to find and really delicious and add an important element but are not dominant. Because the way that we've cooked in the United States for the last 70 or 100 years is a big piece of meat with things around it. And if we can balance that out a little bit and make many things be on the plate, meat can be one of them, then that changes. That changes the pattern of the meal.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Always a pleasure, Evan.
Mark Bittman's latest is the Food Matters Cookbook. I'll be in conversation with the always entertaining Mark Bittman this coming Tuesday night at the Skirball. Details are on the KCRW event calendar. Don't miss it. It'd be great to see you. This morning, David Leite, author of The New Portuguese Table, among other writings about Portuguese food, is with me. His website, Leite's Culinaria, is really an incredible resource. And this morning, we're talking about piri-piri. So, David, tell me, what is piri-piri?
The $1 million question. Piri-piri actually are peppers. They're from originally from South Africa, and they're small little peppers, maybe about an inch long and very thin, and they're called bird's eye peppers also. And they're extraordinarily hot, and they're used in a lot of Portuguese cuisine, especially with grilling recipes.
Now, take me through a little historical geographical lesson. How did a chili from South Africa make its way into Portuguese food?
Well, we have to actually go back to Columbus, because when Columbus went on his journey west, it is supposedly said that he brought back many things, and one of them was the peppers. Now, of course, there are some Portuguese scholars and Portuguese people who would disagree with that, but he brought it back on his journeys and voyages, and it was the Portuguese, who are incredible sailors back then in the Age of Discovery. They were moving down the west coast of Africa along the southern point, which is the Cape of Good Hope, and to the west on their spice trades. So they brought these peppers down and around, and they dropped them off in what would become two of their future colonies, which is Angola and Mozambique. And they grew really well down there, because what makes these peppers grow well is they need to be stressed. So the more heat they get and the more sun, the hotter they become. And down in that South African, meaning the southern part of Africa, the area there, that's the perfect kind of climate to be able to have these peppers get a good balance of fruit and a good balance of heat. And the interesting thing is, on their way back, they brought the peppers to Portugal. So it's a roundabout way of getting the peppers back to Portugal, but it was through the Age of Discovery.
We know that there's this thing called the Scoville scale that let you know how hot a chili is.
Yes.
So give us an idea about this particular chili's level of spiciness.
Well, what's interesting is that it varies depending upon where it's grown and how much it's stressed. Some people have clocked it as low as 30,000, and some people have clocked it as high as 150,000. But a comfortable range, when I spoke to some people in South Africa and also to Portugal, the ones from South Africa probably are anywhere between 60 and 80,000, which is pretty hot. Jalapeno is about 50. And if I'm not mistaken, a Scotch bonnet is, which is really one of the hottest, is way, way up there.
So how is the piri-piri used? Is it dried and turned into something you sprinkle, or is it infused into vinegar or made into a paste?
Here's the interesting thing is that it's used in several ways. Some people, they dry it and they just crush it up and use it in recipes that way. They also grind it up into a very, very fine powder, and you can also purchase it that way. Where I saw it in this wonderful market in Lolé, which is in the Algarve, which is the southern region of Portugal. Very sunny down there and very hot. And what they do is they take the peppers, they dry them, they crush them up and not into a powder, and they mix them with olive oil. And that's how I saw them. But I also found people who take them and then make these incredible sauces beyond that, adding other ingredients. So you might have ginger or lemon. You might have other spices, orange peel or lemon peel, which adds so much more flavor. And they cook the sauce, and they also add some alcohol, because the capsaicin really is only transmitted when there's some sort of fat or oil or alcohol, and that's when you feel the burn. And so the pastes or the sauces that I love are the ones that have all these other aromatics going on. And when you cook it down and then you whiz it in a blender or a food processor, it has these layers of flavor. And what they are is then they're slathered on dishes. They are put alongside so you can dip them in. But one of the most famous ways of doing it is just slathering it on a chicken or slathering it on shrimp, putting it on the grill and grilling it all up. And it's called frango com piri-piri or camarões com piri-piri, which means chicken with piri-piri or shrimp with piri-piri.
Wow, it sounds extremely delicious. Do people actually develop an addiction to it? I know a lot of people who are really into hot pepper sauces. It just seems like the more you dip into hot pastes and sauces, the more you want to dip.
Yeah, these chili heads. I think people do. When I witnessed, when I was in Portugal, in the Algarve especially, there's a town called Guia, and they have something called frango de Guia, which are smaller, more succulent chickens, where they slather them all up and they marinate them in this piri-piri, and then they grill them. And then, you know, gilding the lily, the waiter will say con or sin, which means with or without. And that means either with or without more piri-piri that's slathered on after it's been grilled. So I think these people come back over and over again, and a lot of them are tourists, and many are locals, of course, and they just are addicted to doing this and addicted to these sauces and this particular dish. And they become they have what's called saudade, which means this longing, this missing for something. And they come back year after year, and they have these dishes. So yeah, I think chili heads really can get addicted to this.
So you must have some ideas for something that's a little bit untraditional in terms of using the piri-piri.
I like to make the paste, not the straight sauces, which are just the oil mixed with some garlic and the pepper. I like to make the paste, which have those layers of flavor. So I put them out as dippers when I'm having some sort of hors d'oeuvres. Sometimes I will use a little bit in soups. And sometimes I will, when I make some breads, I fold a little bit into the dough. So it gives a little bit of heat there. So there's lots of different ways that you can do it, rubbing it on meat, pork chops. It's great with pork. I mean, the Portuguese, pork is king in Portugal. So rubbing it on pork is wonderful. Really, any way that you would use a hot sauce here in America, you can use there. And I know that a lot of people use the traditional commercial piri-piri, which incidentally, a lot of the companies, one of the biggest company, they buy their peppers from Mexico. They use cayenne peppers in their piri-piri sauce because they have a particular level of heat that they enjoy, and that's where the cayenne from Mexico comes in. So anywhere that you would use some of those sauces from Mexico or other parts of the world, it's perfect with Portuguese cuisine. You wouldn't be able to really find piri-piri peppers because they're not imported, and many people have taken seeds and grown them in, you know, the Pacific Northwest and say, why are these not that hot? Well, it's not being stressed the way it is in South Africa or in the southern parts of Portugal. But yes, you can use cayenne, you can use arbol, you can use piquen, you can use sentanca. It has to be kind of a medium hot to a hot pepper. And what sometimes I do, if I can't find enough of one, I'll try and find a hotter one, like throw a scotch bonnet in and blend it in with some other ones to kind of like mix the flavors.
Thank you so much, David. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
David Leet is the author of The New Portuguese Table and the publisher of Leet's Culinaria. A few weeks ago, David shared a recipe for Portuguese stuffing on Side Dish, a special bonus podcast that features recipes and side dish ideas from some of our favorite chefs. This week, New Orleans' own Tom Fitzmaurice shares a recipe for oyster dressing from the Big Easy. If you missed any part of today's show, you can download the podcast or listen online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Recipes from Mark Bittman and information on all of today's guests is there too. Good Food is produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Bob Carlson, Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laryl Garcia. Production help comes from Ronnie Mickelson. Gary Messiha is our music supervisor, and Becky Nelson updates our calendar. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman. I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.